For the next 5 weeks, we're going to be using the creative process to undertake a journey of going deeper. Spiritual life is often about going deeper, talked about going deeper. But it's also about going wholeheartedly into the process of being a work in progress. We're going to be summoning, accessing, and engaging with our energies, our muses, our inspirations, things that might terrify us, things that might repulse us, protectors, other aspects of ourselves that at other times of the year we may not think about so much. But listening to Suvanna talk before, I was thinking that this really is a time when there's a lot that seems to just be going on. It's when people start back to school, they sometimes change jobs. There seems to be a lot of energy around this time of year for more creative things. Our schedule at the Buddhist Center tends to get a lot busier in the fall. It's like very calm during the summer. A lot of people are away. But it seems like in the fall, it just, you know, all these things are on the schedule, all these things are happening, festival days. And it's in a way a bit of a harvest feel. There's a lot of things that kind of happen during the year that start having their culminations actually at this time of year. So thinking about this topic of demons to diamonds and of going deeper into our own creative processes, it just occurs to me that in each of ourselves, there are parts of us that are more developed and parts of us that are less developed. There are parts of us that want to know and parts of us that don't want to know. And I think this is an invitation for the more developed parts of ourselves to help the less developed parts of ourselves look at something fresh. The part of this that fascinates me is the area of the mythic dimension, archetypes, symbols. I think all of these are the deep heart's tools to make sense of mysteries about what we are and who we are and what the world is and what things mean to us. This year, we've had a theme of going for refuge. It's been like our theme for the year. And we've had various types of activities and offerings having to do with different parts of this. And I think that going for refuge is sometimes a difficult thing to think about. What does it really mean? What does it mean to me? For me, I think going for refuge is the quest for wholeness, that all of us in our ways, whether we're confused and wandering around from time to time, as we all are, or really having some clarity about a path that we're walking on, I think it's really the quest for wholeness, to progressively integrate all of our various energies, to bring them all together. And I think we're all on heroic quests to glory. We're all wanderers on the path to wholeness, to peace, to liberation, to the wild blue yonder. And going deeper and deeper, more gets revealed. I was thinking about the example of the self as being like the ocean. And when you go out on the ocean, at first it could look almost boring once you get out of the side of land. It's very flat. And there's the curve of the horizon, and especially if there's no clouds in the sky, it looks real big and it looks really empty. And there's... You don't know where to look, actually. What are you going to make of this? And the surface actually is often rarely smooth at all. In fact, there's lots of chop, often quite a lot of waves and spume and spray. And I think that's like how we are on the surface. There's a lot going on. There's all sorts of thoughts. There's feelings, stuff we have to do, all our laundry lists. But as you go deeper, down into calmer regions, things aren't that way. There's deep currents that flow. There's strange beings that you can come upon. It's dark the farther you go down. And it's only dark because it's unexplored. I think our task in practice is to bring the light of awareness. And when we do, we can meet some real surprises down there in the deep. There are undersea volcanoes, there are cold seeps, there are really interesting creatures that can't live by the light of day. There's great pressures down there that make all sorts of interesting things happen with the crust of the earth, the bottom. And going deeper into ourselves, we can meet similar surprises in ourselves. There's a lot of opposites and polarities that we come across, magical attractions, things that we don't know why they repulse us or attract us. They're very odd. And I think that can be frightening unless you're prepared to bring the light of awareness and really shine it there. It takes quite a good deal of courage to go into the depths. One particularly poignant quality that is talked a lot about in Buddhism is Shraddha, which is variously translated as faith, or trust or confidence. I kind of like the trust confidence part myself. I have a little trouble with that word faith. But I read a definition of Shraddha some time ago that I thought was really compelling. It's characterized two ways. That which we most deeply know to be of greatest value, and the longing for what could be. And I think that those are qualities that stand us in good stead as we move deep, as we move deeply and we encounter whatever it is we're going to encounter. Along the way, I think we are liable to encounter all the mythic and archetypal symbols that can come up. And they come up in various ways, through our art, through reading, through dreams, things that just strike us on the bus and startle us for no good reason that we can tell why. Poems that speak out of books to us. So I would ask you to consider what things are attractive to you as we go through this process, as we go through these weeks. One of these mythic figures that I like to contemplate a lot is the Dakini. And we have a couple little Dakinis here. We have one that's on the front of this lantern, which we haven't lit. And then here's a little rupa of a Dakini. Dakinis are talked a lot about in all of the scriptures, particularly in the Vajrayana. You get a lot of stories about them in cremation grounds. And some of the Dakinis that are in cremation grounds are really actually pretty nasty little figures. They're very untamed. They eat flesh. They torment people that come along. They're really not very, very good beings. But there's something about them that can be tamed. And like this little Dakini, these two little Dakinis here, they're examples of Dakinis that have transformed themselves, that have heard the truth, that have taken it on, and they have tamed their energies with help. And they're really, Dakinis can be our spiritual muses. They're considered in the tantric kind of scheme of things, they're the secret Sangha refuge, which I've always thought was quite interesting. I'm not going to go too much into that, but just to say that as spiritual muses, they're agents of spiritual change for us. They're the parts of us that that work sometimes way below our radar, but they come up sometimes fiercely, sometimes kind of beckoning us. They can appear in the guise of a friend who challenges us or a situation that challenges us. The thing about them is that you have to nourish them or they shrivel up. They really are creative parts. And I was, in writing this talk, I remembered this really sad story about Charles Darwin. And I read this some time ago and it really chilled me to hear this story. He started off life quite an intensely poetic young man. And in fact, I think he studied for the priesthood and, you know, did some preaching and stuff, not in the Catholic tradition, but I think it was Church of England. But then he was really entranced by science and became quite drawn into the process of figuring out what are all these species, what are bones about, what are fossils about, what led to what. And he really devoted his life to that. And he always sort of thought, oh, well, you know, I love poetry, but I'll get back to it. I'll get back to doing this one day when I'm older, you know, after I've gone off around the world to the, you know, on the HMS Beagle and found out all those things. He came back later in years and wrote up all his stuff and then thought, oh, I'm going to go back to poetry. And he found he couldn't write. He couldn't write anymore. The words would not come. His inspiration just dried up. And he realized then that because he had forgotten all about it, he never actually paid attention to this, he lost that ability. And I read that and I was chilled because I thought, oh, you know, the world and our workplaces, our, you know, all the demands of daily life, they really don't encourage us to pay attention to those very important things in the center of us, all those ways that we could be creative. And I don't want to let that go. I don't want to ever lose touch with that part because that's the wellspring of my life. And it's what gives my life meaning. I think it's, if you don't cultivate that, you will lose it. So Dakinis need to be nourished. And I also think we need to respect them. They're powerful parts of our mythic landscape. And if we diss them, they can turn really nasty. They can turn tricky. And so I think one of the things that this time, this series will offer us is using creative processes so that we can kind of make acquaintance with our Dakinis. We'll have a chance during these sessions to look at things that appear dark, even demonic. And we'll have the opportunity to watch these things change as we welcome them and get to know them for the friends and the protectors that they can be transformed into. They'll surprise us with their beauty and their meaning. So I'd like to read this little excerpt. I first heard this many years ago on retreat. And I'd invite you just to sort of relax and just take it in for whatever it has to offer. It's from a story called Ashy Paddle. And Ashy Paddle, or Ash, is a character in this story. Ash says, "I am about my mother's business. They can call it witchcraft if they like. It's not military, it's not clerical, and it certainly is not noble, so witchcraft for the remainder will do. As for sin, what sin is there in listening to the inspirations and improvisations of the natural world? There, quite clearly and unmistakable, that little bird standing on a branch of my mother's glorious grave tree sings, 'Look, look, look at me,' meaning the tree with the bird. That precise moment and that precise posture on that actual twig of the tree, which is filled by its witchcraft, the space in this world in which my mother vacated. Spirits need no clothes, nor do they those who converse with spirits. Skin is the dress in which we meet the gods. Therefore, I assist my concentration by remaining sky-clad, as they say, within the shelter of this tree, which bodies forth my mother's name in its name and mine, Ash. Look, look, look at me. And this is what the clothes I have discarded were saying, and the reason why they were discarded. Now the bird sings, 'Be black, be black.' It is as I now know that I must remain naked at all times for my work, whether it is housecraft or witchcraft. For a naked person in this land is regarded as invisible, as though their skin absorbed all visibility and they were black. Being black and clad like the night sky, I have become clean, too, like a spirit. I am become the very ghost of a black fairy, a piece of invisible night. The convention that they worship, and which seals their eyes against all invisibles, forbids their seeing or even looking at me as I run my skin up and downstairs, bringing them their dishes and candles in my invisible hands. I have free passage between the worlds, between two worlds, for which I wish to enter the social order. I simply put on a dress, and I am in it immediately. My white working dresses, as they dirtied, drew closer to freedom and invisibility. But now they are burnt to black cinders, and there's no suitable dress within my knowledge that will admit me to that house as anything less than a spirit, or to those parties. There are the people prance and simper in their exaggerated clothing, echoing and anticipating every movement, and quelling those not acceptable. They need the vents of big collars and the chimneys of immense sleeves in order to notice their own selves. Only by abstraction and amplification can they envisage others. Or by dotted pearls hypnotized with satin surfaces. Be black, be black. I wear my uterine skin to be near the sources of creation, and they can only see that as darkness. Darkness and absence and invisibility running sky-clad through the house as it might be along the branches of this tree to learn, to learn. Look, look, look at me, says the birdwood tree, the grave tree that has over the months grown and formed itself. I see now into a perfect model of the spaces of the house bequeathed by my mother to my father, the general. Just as the tree has replaced her absence, so has its wood clothed in leaves entered the social order, penetrating by twig and branch and constructing a solid negative or model in reverse. Where there are capacious rooms and empty halls, there is solid living wood. Where there is bricks and mortar, open breathing air. That big knot is the front door and the buttress root and the bowl of the front hall. The trunk is the big winding main staircase. These branches give the patterns of the room en suite. Look, look, look at me. I can tell off the whole of my house in this tree. I have run since babyhood along every tree and corridor up to the airy attic tiled with foliage. There is the learned Claire's room where this bough turns and swells at the joint. Fickle Dowsabelle's playroom with the white bed and the tin soldiers where it rises and thins into the long, narrow gallery with windows. And there's my father's Spartan chamber in this straight bow, my stepmother's cathedral-like bedroom in this swollen gall. Look, look, look at me! And this solid map of my house in my underground mother's again-living flesh tells me once more what I have forgotten. In her private apartments below ground level, her forgotten cellar room, her withdrawing rooms for magic that my father, the general, sealed off and forbade her, and for which she pined to death, her subterranean spinning room, her chambers of masks, her walk-in wardrobes of wonder-awaking dresses. Be black, black, black. These rooms in my tree plans, where she lies, where she herself lies within the magical soil, putting on her new guises, are also in actuality here below the cellarage of the house. Thus I penetrate the dark rooms, crypt upon crypt, using no lights, just at each new archway, pausing at the threshold to listen to the sound of the pitch-black space that opens before me, and by that resonance guiding my footsteps with echo and touch of air and the smell of stone and where it vaults or opens. This is why the earth called me, and the discarded, disregarded, dirty thing, so that I would one day be able to navigate this underground darkness to my mother's domains. Now I can unseal these rooms because I can see their doors and their golden fastenings by body light. And as the new air rushes in the perfume long pent in her dresses and implements, is the sweetest air I have ever smelt and brings with it such light as seems to be turning on lamp after brilliant lamp in our new and old wonderland in the roots of the house and in the roots of the tree. Now I sit down at her immense dark mirror and learn to clothe myself anew and enter the many worlds. She wears the long series of wonder-awaking dresses. She wears the fish-skin cloak. She wears the gown of pearl with constellations slashed into its dark linings. She undresses out of the night sky, each night of the year, a different sky. She wears altitude dresses and vertigo dresses. She plucks open the long staircase at the neck with the big buttons of bird skulls in the white dress of sow thistle. She has leather breeches known to be chimp skin. She has combed star rays into shaggy nightdresses. She has a bodice of bone flounces, a turbinal blouse through which the air pours. There is a gown she has that shimmers without slit or seam like the wall of an aquarium. A starfish moves slowly on its pumps across her bosom. A shark glides, a turtle rows silently between her knees. And she adopts in turn the long dress of the sewn louse skin, the romper suit of purple jam packed with tiny oval seeds, the foggy gray dress and the lapping between its folds, bird cries and meteor noises and declarations of love echo, the ball gown of ticker tape, the evening dress of flexible swirling clockwork running against time, the cocktail dress of bloody smoke and bullet-torn bandages, and the little black dress of grave soil that rends and seals as she turns. Often she sits up all night in the general's library, sewing strong patches from his wardrobe of military thought into her wounded dresses. So I want to leave you with two questions that you can reflect on as we meet through these 5 weeks. What moves you most deeply? Who are you in the heart of your hearts?